In talking about these things, when it takes place, that when there's a relationship between a person and a let's call it a therapist, he says, and a person, you know, reveals whatever it is he's been keeping within confession. Boysen makes this point. It is now recognized that it is not the mere confession which effects the cure, but the socialization. Remember what he means by socialization? Because keeping this a secret has isolated you. By sharing it with another person, that whatever it was has now been socialized. And he says, and then he explains, the cure is only effected insofar as the sufferer tells his real difficulties. Now here he says this is the ideal situation to someone whom he trusts, someone who stands to him as the prototype of the father and the representative of authority. This is especially in the psychoanalytic situation, but it will always be more effective if it's somebody that does stand in some kind of relationship of authority or seniority or so on like that.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm on page 244. And the foundation of spiritual hearing. The cure is only effected insofar as the sufferer tells his real difficulty to somebody whom he trusts. See, somebody, I mean, doesn't really have to be an authority, but he, you see, let's say there's a group of people that you take as normative. They're the ones whose opinion counts. Let's say that good devotees, whose respect, that you whose approval you need and want. So this person has to be at least one of the... It doesn't do any good if you've got a particular fault to say somebody, yeah, I do that too, you know, so what? You know, you you want somebody who represents to you something like what you think is the best. So it has to be at least a good devotee, a prototype of the Father, the representative authority, and who is yet able to hear the worst without condemning him. Condemning him, again, it doesn't mean that you say what you've done, you don't say that, oh, that isn't wrong. But at least you don't condemn the person. You don't say, oh, you know, you're not one of us. You know, when it's a come to me, when occasions come to me that somebody has had to come to me and tell me that they've fallen down some way, my usual response is, oh, you must feel terrible. You know, not you, you know, you're terrible, or you even did a terrible thing, but you must feel really, because the person is usually actually feels really terrible. You must feel really bad. You actually, you know, I mean, that's part of the process of socialization on this thing. Of course he feels horrible. And the fact that he does feel horrible is great. If he didn't feel horrible, then what relation, say if it's my disciple, what relationship does he have with me if he doesn't feel horrible? So in one sense, I'm happy that he feels bad about it. And I'm really happy that the person has come to me about it. Now we can reestablish the relationship. You see? So this is the socialization that Boysen is talking about. In the other essay, the second one, the distinctive task of the minister of religion, which I really like because, you know, it lists all the different kinds of people with which he has to deal and with to whom he has obligations. And I've stressed before, I think ISKCON has a lot of times disowned its obligations. It's not always our fault. We're busy. Sometimes we get too busy spreading Krishna consciousness to take care of the people that we already have, you know. Once somebody has become a devotee, okay, we can forget about them and go on to the next person.
Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great. What about Alexander the Great?
Conquer when
terrible. Yeah, he was no good at
managing. Then he would neglect that and go on and do something else, but didn't lose the
That's why the whole thing fell apart. Yeah, he was no good at follow-through. And we've tended to lack that also. That's true about Alexander the Great. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true. But he was just a kid. Like us.
Great kid.
He was very young when he died. Everyone was very old. Yeah, he liked conquering rather than maintaining. You know, so
some people like to preach, but they can't maintain.
Well, we have to have our people that maintain, and that's what the ministering function is. And and we can be criticized for that. I think and the point of such criticism is we should start making sure we repair this kind of stuff. So that's one thing that's important. And the other thing is what he talks about. What does he mean by a dynamic morality? A shift from a static to dynamic standard of morality. Yeah.
Not that, you know, you're bad because you've broken certain rules, or, you know, you're good because you follow the rules, but because if someone is actually improving, then they're good.
Yeah. Yeah. He puts it here most succinctly on page 268. I then try to shift the basis of self-respect from the rigid or static type of morality to the dynamic type. I mean, this doesn't deny that there are rules and regulations, but the basis of judgment is what he changes. The basis of self-respect, really. On what grounds can a person have? Because he's dealing with people who have a devastating loss of self-respect. Right? I try to get him to see that no matter how unworthy one may have been, see, he doesn't deny the unworthiness. You see, this is what makes Boysen so different from most modern types of psychotherapy. Well, you're not unworthy because, you know, it's not bad. He says, I try to get him to see that no matter how unworthy one may have been, he is a good man, read person, and worthy of honor insofar as he or she is eagerly seeking to become better. So that's nice, eagerly seeking to become better. So it's not where you are that he looks at, it's where you are earnestly trying to go. You know, and if you're earnestly trying to become better, then that's why he says it's dynamic. The person is in process to something better, and that's what we have to look for. And as I said, this is this is what's meant by when a person is considered to be a sadhu, even though he's committed something abominable, if he's correctly situated in his determination, that he's earnestly seeking to become better. This means correctly situated in one's determination.
Yeah. How about if the person doesn't show any symptoms of eagerness to improve?
Well, then you're going to have difficulty as a counselor, and you may be not making the most effective use of your time in dealing with this person. Then you have to wait. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, he talks about in this chapter about the minister that there are people who are just, you know, blocked and not going anywhere. But he talks about the opportunity that comes with the distressed, those who are in jeopardy, those who are passing through periods of crisis and mutation. Because then, you know, the ultimate values will come out. Now, you know, a really good example of that from Srimad Bhagavatam is Vidura's dealing with Dhritarashtra. You know, Dhritarashtra is a guy who had, you know, his concealment and evasion devices. And they're explained very clearly what it was. You know, he had followed the wrong path. He had done, supported the wrong cause. He had suffered a crushing defeat, and yet now he was maintaining his self-respect by saying, you know, well, I'm actually the elder person in the family. I'm the uncle of the king, and Maharaj Yudhisthira was treating him with that proper respect. So he had gotten quite puffed up. It was almost like he had won. Here he tried to kill them for so many years, and now all of a sudden he's their beloved uncle. right? So you see what he had done, how he was maintaining his self-respect in the face of everything. But he was getting old and weak, and so Vidura, finally seeing, you know, he went in there and disturbed him. Remember earlier we read what Boysen said, actually it was in this chapter, that sometimes we have a duty to disturb people, what he calls the unawakened, that group. Sometimes you need to precipitate a crisis. Well, that's what Vidura did. And he pointed out, you know, your teeth are loose, your liver is failing, you know, you're coughing up mucus, and so on. He lists all that. You're living like a household dog. You're eating the remnants of the food of Bhima.
That's a chopping technique.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the chopping. Sometimes it's there. That's a perfect example. Yeah.
No, I believe it just is Kamsa.
With whom?
Kamsa. You precipitated also the advent of Krishna. Like in the sense he...
With whom?
Kamsa.
Kamsa. Oh, yeah, he didn't clear him up. He just egged him on, you know. He didn't, you know.
He brought it to a head.
Yeah, but that was a different thing. It wasn't preaching, huh?
Just
it was manipulating.
In support of what you were saying in this Apiche Sudarachara Shlok, at the end of the purport, Prabhupada mentions that one may fall down and say that the is strong, but then we should take advantage of this.
Yeah.
The last line of the purport is he said if he doesn't improve his character, it should be understood he's not a high devotee.
Yeah.
But not that he's not a devotee.
No, not a high devotee.
He's not a high devotee, still means he's a devotee, and therefore there may be some obligation trying to wake him.
Yes. Anybody who hangs around, I think we should think that we have an obligation. Now, we may not be able to do anything except wait. But we shouldn't ignore them. If the census form they write Hare Krishna as their religion, you know, they're ours. What can you do? Now the other thing is this chart, which you all have, I hope, will study fairly closely again. As I said, I want to make sure that everybody is very clear about these different degrees of socialization, and so we're going to virtually duplicate the same exercise as we did the last time. So this is an easy one. But let's make sure we understand these four levels of socialization. And you see, this is one defect of this chart. Is that a concealment device which isolates one in one community can be used as something to socialize one in another community. In other words, people get together and they have the concealment device, they've distorted their ideals or their standards, right, to conceal what they're doing. So to seek social validation and support, they form maybe a subgroup or an overlapping group, and there they all get together and say, yeah, you know, this is the real thing. And therefore, they and then they're a group two or three, contemporary local adjustment, or even a somewhat of a rebellious anti-establishment attitude. Many people sometimes have their feet in two groups, and they go back and forth. You know, somebody who leaves ISKCON and joins the army, you know, may not have their feet in two groups. But there are many other, you know, groups that have two things, and something that in the major group, let's say ISKCON, is disapproved of. In their subgroup, they have social reinforcement and support for that same thing. You know, the little secret chocolate eaters club. You know, I think the GBC was being really punctilious when they banned chocolate. And we get together, you know, and we had chocolate fondues. Or something, you know, I don't know. So you have to understand this about this chart. But otherwise, it sort of comes out like, you know, goodness, passion, and ignorance, pretty much. The socialization with the attitudes of aspiration, faith, and reverence, where it has this confession and forgiveness. This is the basically confession, forgiveness, and then there's reconciliation. That's the other thing that follows. Reconciliation means social support and reinforcement. That's the means. And then there's, this is the society of pure devotees. Now, he doesn't talk much about the process of this process of socialization on the highest level. It's not within the scope of what Boisen is talking about. But certainly we have a great deal to talk about that in ISKCON. And actually, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Shishastika prayers talks a lot about it, really. But anyway, it's not what we're talking about. And then the next one down is the well-adjusted person, the normal man, but who's really well-adjusted on a somewhat lower level. He may have substituted minor for major virtues, but that's the world at large has done this in many ways. So they're well adjusted, they're the normal person, but their ultimate loyalties are really on the back burner. It's not that they disown those ultimate loyalties, but they just, find a convenient way of dealing with them later, or just trying to get through it pro forma. This is the ones that Boisen calls the unawakened. And sometimes it's necessary to disturb.
A lot of those with the concealment reaction mode could also be in that category, wouldn't
it? Yeah, but
compromised aversion.
Yeah, that's always going on. And you'll see a little bit of flippancy, a little bit of the rebellious attitude there, making jokes, like all the Roman Catholic priest jokes and all this other stuff. Humor is a great outlet for the normal man by which they can kind of get a little tension off by the fact of not having, come up to the highest standard. And the Roman Catholic priest jokes are typical because they're kind of biting, but they're affectionate at the same time, generally.
Oh, yeah.
Unlike UBC jokes, maybe. Uh-huh. Or Jewish rabbi jokes, that's another field of are great ones. Even better, actually. Wish I knew a few. I never remember jokes.
If you're interested in Varnashram without understanding what it's in service of, could that be in that contemporary level?
Yeah, I think so. I think in Vedic culture, the Varnashram Dharma allows for that with an understanding. But it's done in such a way that you can gradually, the whole Vedic system is gradually designed so that you go up. Whereas to today, contemporary local adjustment is no longer allows for much of that. Yeah?
John, what Manaji said, when you say that maybe a large portion of this kind would fit in the second group, contemporary local adjustment, let's say on a Vedic level.
You mean greater ISKCON?
Maybe. Standing around, but you're busy with, Dhamma, Artha,
No, that depends on the individual. You can't just tell by what you do. It's really how you do it. It's really, you don't have to be a full-time preacher in order to be socializing on the highest level, if that's what you mean.
You were making the point that Varnashram that you see is a way for someone to socialize on a lower level without being inside the goal. So we talk about 2 feet in different boats or 2 feet in different camps. It would seem that a lot of this kind of religious folks that aren't pure devotees at this point would have their feet in 2 different camps.
No, if they're not pure devotees and they're earnestly seeking to become better, then I would say that they're in group one. Now it shades off, it definitely does. It shades off. But group two, like a kshatriya who's in the first camp, fights for Krishna. A kshatriya in the second camp fights in the cause of Dharma in general, with the understanding that he's going to go to the heavenly planets. It's a difference really between the heavenly planets and the kingdom of God. That's how I see it. I understand there's going to be another ISKCON in the heavenly planets in addition to the spiritual sky. I'm quite aware of that. But,
And wouldn't somebody in the first group anyway, even if they were on that highest level, in order to set the example externally, they wouldn't know?
Yeah, they might appear anywhere.
Operate on the second.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you can't tell just by what people are doing. That's the only point I'm trying to make.
Someone may appear to be on the higher level, but then the second level.
Yep, that's the other thing. Then there's the rebellious and development of cancer-like social formations. We discussed that already, the juvenile delinquent and that kind of thing. A few more words about this dependence, idolatry, submergence, the partisan, the clinging vine. As I said, I think that's more of a danger in our society than anywhere else. Let me say a few words about this submergence. I found a place where Boysen talks about it that I neglected to mention earlier. In addition to, he's talking about maintaining their loyalty, those who maintain their loyalties who substitute a minor loyalty for a major loyalty. He's already talked about substituting major for minor virtues, but submergence is like substituting a minor for a major loyalty, which is a nice way of putting it. In the devotion of the wife or mother who sinks her own individuality into that of a husband or son, and who finds thus the end and meaning of her life, there may be something fine and ennobling. In her, as also in the loyal follower who devotes himself to some institution or to some finite leader, we may have also the expression of a higher loyalty. It may be connected to something higher. But such devotion may, and all too often does, become a hindrance to the full development of all concerned. The devotion to the church may become the blind and mischievous sectarianism which thwarts the end for which the church exists. The loyalty to the country may become the unthinking patriotism which offers its life on the altar of a cruel and rapacious war god, or a short-sighted tyranny which seeks to suppress all liberty of thought and speech. The mother's devotion, that is to the son, may hang as a dead weight around her son's neck, preventing him from achieving maturity. In other words, devotion to a finite love object may, not always, but may become a substitute for that loyalty, the highest, which is indispensable to mental health, both personal and social. That's a really nice passage, I think. I wish I'd read it to you earlier. I somehow rather skipped over it.
Do we have that mentioned?
No, it's not. It's in another chapter. But it explains, I think it, at least you should become clear what he means about this substitution of loyalties in some ways. And usually that entails substitution of loyalties to another group of a lower standard sometimes. But in ISKCON, you see how the spiritual master is a finite object. It's not God. Devotion to the spiritual master, if it's correct, goes through him to Krishna. But if it also becomes submergence, it actually stops there and replaces Krishna. That's why I talked about unhealthy forms of surrender to the spiritual master. And so Boysen acknowledges that, the finite love object is not always bad. Just like love for ISKCON can be to further the cause of Krishna. But, when as I've seen the tendency somehow, membership in ISKCON or ISKCON, loyalty to ISKCON becomes a substitute for spiritual advancement, then you've got a problem. And when it's a lot easier to go to war, it's a lot easier to substitute for the real war on Maya the war against the Ritviks or against the anti-cultists or against, you know, whoever it may be our current enemies are, when that replaces, you know, the war against Maya, then you got a problem. Then, you know, being loyal to ISKCON actually blocks your spiritual advancement. That doesn't just say, you know, to fight against the enemies of ISKCON is wrong at all. You see, that's not the problem. The problem is, what's the mechanism that's going on, whether it's a substitute. Because there are some people who turn out they're not happy unless they have an enemy. And you have to say, well, why is that? You know, but they need an enemy. And that enemy is usually the substitute for the real enemy, which is, you know, there's the Hiranyakashipu in the heart that you're not dealing with, so you're looking for the Hiranyakashipus out there. But Prabhupada had already said that the real enemy is within ISKCON. We can't be defeated by anybody outside, it's only inside. There was a famous cartoon character in America years ago, Pogo, and his slogan was, "We have met the enemy and he is us." But when you don't want to know that it's what's in your own heart, then you get these kinds of submergence and things like that. I mean, it also, as he said to you, and as you get Nazis and, you know, fanatical communists or fanatical anything. I know people that they just have to be fanatics. Any god will do. I knew one guy who was a fanatical Hare Krishna. He became deprogrammed and he became a fanatical anti-Hare Krishna. He was the same guy. He just had to be a fanatic. So this is what happens, right? So anyway, this socialization thing you should notice. Now, the other kind of stuff that we studied in this the concealment reactions, they don't really line up as clearly as these levels of socialization. Things much more mixed and confused. But you know, you should understand these different devices of compromise, diversion, bluffing, shifting responsibility. He mentions the shifting responsibility, you know, from, in other words, you know, when the German army was defeated in World War I, this is a famous incident in history, they were defeated in World War I. Well, the invincible German army couldn't be defeated. Instead, they were stabbed in the back by traitors at home. Right? And that was the big thing. And then they went around looking for traitors. And the same thing happened when the American army lost in Vietnam. It was Jane Fonda who did it. They were stabbed in the back by the peacenecks at home, you know. That's an example of shifting responsibility. And that person unto whom you shift blame, that is called a scapegoat, you know. That's from an old Jewish custom. You would take a goat. And this goat would be, you would hang, I don't know, rocks or ribbons on it or something which represented all your sins, and you'd drive it out into the wilderness, and that was called a scapegoat. You know? So a scapegoat has come to mean that person, you know, the famous scapegoats of Europe are the Jews, you know, whoever they may be, that you blame for all your troubles because you don't want to deal with it yourself. And so a lot of times we scapegoat, if I haven't made any spiritual advancement, well, it must be ISKCON's fault. Now, ISKCON may have faults, but the scapegoating is, the mechanism is to absolve yourself of your responsibility. And ISKCON a lot of times absolves itself of responsibility when somebody leaves by saying, well, you know, they were in Maya, they did this, that, 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 and we never acknowledge our own failures of our obligations toward those people too. In both cases, the shifting of blame goes on. And to an organic scapegoat, this is the person who can't perform any devotional service and always sick, always this, all this trouble, that trouble, one doctor, another trouble, this healing modality, that healing modality, that healing modality, that healing modality, with a constant bid for attention, sympathy, attention, I need this, you know. We may have seen that also. It happens in life everywhere. Again, fault finding, which we know about. It's not, again, fault finding is I mean, the exemplar of the fault finder. in fault finding, it's not, the issue is not the presence of actual fault. There can be actual fault, but you can still be a fault finder. You can also make up faults and be a fault finder. Or you can exaggerate. One form of fault finding is this punctiliousness. You know, like Ramachandrapuri. You know, the big sign of spiritual advancement was, you know, you didn't eat sweets and you took the little rules and regulations and you substituted the minor for the major virtues. You know, that's our Ramachandrapuri. That's that kind of fault finding. But there can be, sometimes there is fault. But the idea is that, you know, that's all you notice and that's all you see and that's all you're interested in. That's what makes the fault finding. So it's not the presence of action or absence of actual faults in others that make one a fault finder. It's when one needs to have it and seeking it out and so on like that. And there's a difference between fault finding and constructive criticism, and it's exactly that.
Is fault finding an attitude or a manifestation of this compromise, you assume?
Well, it's a form of concealment. And sometimes it shows itself in fault finding.
Fault finding.
Cynicism, fault finding, these are all kinds of compromise and concealment. And I mentioned others. There's the substitution of minor for major virtues or loyalties, as we talked about. Now, there's something else that actually I think is missing from this chart. I finally found a way to improve upon Boysen of looking for his faults. You know, actually, I mean, under this list of concealment devices and evasive techniques is the distortion of ideals and standards. He mentions that in his text, but he doesn't put it in his chart. Now, in some ways, a substitution of a minor for a major virtue is one form of distortion, but sometimes you just, you know, change the philosophy to suit your actual practices. As he talks about the doctrine of vicarious atonement, remember that? See, that's not a substitution of a minor for a major virtue, but it is a distortion of the standards. So a lot of time we see this distortion of ideals and standards, you know. And you'll see something like, somebody says something like, you know, 4 good rounds are better than 16 bad rounds. And the real reason Prabhupada wanted us to chant 16 is so we'd actually get in 4 good ones by hit or miss. And so I just make sure I chant 4 good ones. See, for example. That what I would call a distortion of the ideals and standards. Yeah?
Is there a thought finding? Is there the flip side of that, a kind of lack of discrimination, or a kind of Pollyanna where you never see any fault?
Well, that's an interesting one. I don't know if we have time to discuss it.
People's life they go through and they just refuse to make any discrimination.
Use it. Let me think. Well, I have to think about that one. Yeah.
Kind of like pure devotion.
Well, not, yeah, I don't know. No.
Against yourself.
Everything's wonderful, everyone's so nice, everybody's so,
a kind of false, you know, little
offering. Yeah, I've seen that, you know. Tennessee Williams in his plays always has a female character that's like that. I have always depended upon the kindness of strangers. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, I have to think about that.
I'm confused by the chart.
Yeah.
The compromise reaction mode.
Yeah.
It seems that there's two types of attitudes that come from that, according to the chart. One would be the cynicism and fault finding. maintenance of self-respect through depreciation. Mm-hmm. The other one would be maintenance of primary...
Yeah, they're two different kinds of concealment mechanisms.
But they're...
But see, these things are much... They're not as clearly defined as these areas of socialization. You're finding people, they blend, they mix. Sometimes it's like this, sometimes it's like that.
But they're both under the
category... Yeah, they're both under the category of compromise.
Compromise. And, yeah. I'm not really sure that I can understand the substitution of primary loyalties from the vague conception of the definition of compromise, but I don't know if I see that maintenance of self-respect through depreciation of others as a compromise and how that really fits into that.
Well, it's a compromise because, see, you're still maintaining... Now, self-respect, that is to say, you're gonna think yourself a good member of the community. Your idea is, I'm going to be a good member of this community. I haven't left this community.
You're not looking at your own faults.
But you're not looking at your own faults. And so you think you're better by looking at how everybody else is worse. You know. So it's the woman who's a gossip who's always complaining that other people are engaged in prajalpa all the time, you know. I don't know why they come to me. They always do. Everybody always comes to me and they tell me these things. You know what she told me? Anyway, we have to wind up here. So you should understand that sometimes there's a shifting of loyalties also takes place. When a concealment, you socialize your concealment by also shifting loyalties to a group of a lower standard. And that's when this socialization also blends with this concealment mechanism. Depends on what group you're in. And there's other things that you should understand. We know what a misanthrope is, for example. Misanthrope. Yeah? Yeah, but it means really a hater of human beings, hater of humanity, the misanthrope. The cynic. Cynic is one who what?
Feels everyone's ill motivated.
Yeah, everyone's got bad motives. Everyone works with self-interest. You know, no, everyone's selfish. They're no different than me. This is a cynic. He's convinced that everybody is selfish. Punctiliousness, we understand what that means, right? Making something big out of little tiny things. That was Ramachandrapuri's trip. A prude, pruditry.
Chase other chase.
Yeah, well, really, a prude is somebody that puts undue emphasis on merely negative virtues. That's the way he defines it in the text there. You know, only he's concerned with, like, the negative things.
That was the limbs and white meat example?
Huh?
Limbs and white meat?
So yeah. Sometimes like, yeah, uh-huh. And you get really things about... and a Pharisee, anybody remember what a Pharisee is?
It's a big hypocrite.
Yeah, it's just sensitive hypocrite is, you know... The Pharisee is more like an obsessive Karmakanda Brahmin. It was from a Jewish group who emphasized, you know, very close following of the rules and regulations. And they're the ones that used to, you know, go to Jesus and say, you know, hey, look, you know, you healed this guy and it was the Sabbath, so you broke the law, you know. Things like that, you know. So Prabhupada would sometimes get criticized by the ritualistic Brahmins for so many things he did that broke the rules, you know. That's Phariseeism, when you know you think that salvation comes just by following all the rules and regulations and nothing more.
Yeah.
And your heart's like a stone. Okay, I guess that's all the... Anyway, it's, the power's off and it's time to end. So, okay, so tomorrow we'll have an ecstatic exam. I'll see you then. Kalpadiki Ijai.
Bye.